content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 10, 2025. As usual, the front cover's bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Women of the Year is captioned on the cover in white. Time is in large block capital lettering in white, superimposed upon a portrait of a woman, Nicole Kidman, plus 12 leaders building a more equal future. Nicole Kidman is blonde, with actually variations in color of blondness from white to almost auburn, not quite, certainly strawberry blonde. Blue eyes, she's looking askance from the camera. It is just a headshot. Beginning then with the first article, which is not the women, we will get to them. America's Aging Workforce. This is under the caption of Nation. Why the Promise of Retirement is Slipping Out of Reach by Alana Samuels, Waitsfield, Waitsfield, Vermont. There's a photo here. Full page plus a margin or two. It is captioned, Walter Carpenter, 69, on the job at Mad River Glen, the ski resort where he works, 4 days a week. The photographs are by John Tully for Time. Mr. Carpenter here is carrying stuff. He may be working in a kitchen or a commissary or something like that. He does look a bit bedraggled, I must say, as a co-senior citizen. His hair is gray and a bit long and shaggy. He has gray facial hair. He has a really sparkling smile behind that facial hair on his upper lip. He's wearing a cap, like a baseball cap, but it says something like Mill Rocks, something like that. It's greenish. His shirt is long-sleeved and green. It's like a pullover. He's got a white shirt under that. He's got a black apron over the top. He's wearing black, probably latex gloves. He's got a couple of towels, like kitchen towels, hanging from the string or the cord on his apron. He's got a plastic pitcher and two stacks of colored glasses, not eyeglasses, the glasses you drink from. One stack is red, one is amber. Behind him, there are stainless steel apparatuses. I cannot describe what they are because they're blurry. But anyway, Mr. Walter Carpenter, 69, is on the job and smiling at the camera. Walter Carpenter walks across the ski resort's dining room on a knee that needs to be replaced and a hip that's going bad. Lumbering into the kitchen, he deposits a brown bin of dirty dishes on a counter before heading back out to collect more bowls of half-eaten tomato soup and plates littered with sandwich crusts. One foot in front of the other, he jokes to kitchen prep worker Kim Hopper as they pass each other. Carpenter, 69, has worked winters at the Mad River Glen ski area in Waitsfield, Vermont, for the past 15 years. 4 times a week, he clocks in around noon, makes $20 per hour carrying dishes up and down the 3 flights of stairs in the base box, as the kitchen and bar area is called, putting plastic food baskets and metal tongs and soup ladles in their rightful place, loading the industrial dishwasher with cups and bowls. He has peripheral neuropathy, which can leave him without feeling in his feet or legs. Some days his phone tells him he walks more than 5 miles during his shifts. He never thought he'd be on the job at this age, but without much in retirement savings, Carpenter has no plans to stop. "I'm broke and poor and still working at 69, he says, as he once again ascends the carpeted gray stairs with a bin full of dishes, his shoulders slightly stooped, his gray mustache and hair hidden under a baseball cap, a scruffy Einstein with a slight Boston accent. But at least I'm still here." Mad River Glen, where a daily adult lift ticket costs $115, could not run without staffers like Carpenter. If you include part-timers on the ski patrol, the kitchen crew, and the employees at the retail shop, about half its workers are over 65, according to marketing coordinator Rye Young. That's not entirely surprising in Vermont, where about 26% of residents 65 and older are still working, the highest share in the U.S. The state is at the forefront of a national trend. As birth rates decline and the country ages, older people are staying in the workforce longer. Today, about 19% of people 65 and older in the U.S. are still working, up from 10% 4 decades ago. They do it for a variety of reasons. Some, like John Mandeville, 75, executive director of the Central Vermont Council on Aging, find fulfillment from their jobs and want to keep going until they can't anymore. Others, like Hopper, the prep cook, have ample retirement savings but still want to be around people and work part-time to stay connected. But about half of workers 65 and older are people like Carpenter, according to Craig Copeland, director of Wealth Benefits Research at Employee Benefit Research Institute. For one reason or another, an illness, an investment scam, a lifetime of jobs without a pension or means to save for retirement, they have no choice but to keep working to pay the bills. For these people, the finish line can feel miles away, and every time it draws closer, something moves it back again. Maybe they thought they could get by with their retirement savings until inflation started climbing. Or perhaps they were on track to quit at 65 until the stock market took a dive. Many are like Carpenter, who has worked for 55 years doing construction, picking apples, running ski lifts, managing parking lots, but cannot retire because most of his jobs were low-paying with meager benefits. There will likely be more of these Americans in the years to come. Half of babies born in the U.S. in 2007 are projected to live to 103, according to the World Economic Forum. As lifespans lengthen, wages are not keeping up with inflation, and even a decent nest egg may not go far enough. That's especially true as employers have shifted the burden of retirement savings to employees, offering 401ks rather than pensions that promise a certain benefit every month. As a result, millions of Americans are going to have to keep working longer. The issue, more than anything, is the high cost of living, says Mandeville, Council on Aging director. It is really strained. It has really strained people's retirement budgets. the growing class of people who want to stop working but can't represents a crack in a social compact that assured citizens who worked hard that they could take it easy when they hit 65, if not before. As that crack grows, it will put economic strain on younger generations who have to care for family members, contributing to a growing burden of debt that includes student loans and home ownership. Retirement savings will become one more discouraging thing that young workers cannot afford, as their costs grow, but their wages do not. 40 years ago, a teacher or a municipal worker or an employee on a manufacturing line was guaranteed a good retirement after putting their time in. Today, more people are working in service industry jobs, but longtime workers like Walter Carpenter cannot afford retirement. I just have to keep working, he says, as he clears away dirty dishes. Right now, retirement is a distant dream. Now, here's another photo. It's about a fourth of a page. It's in color, but it's mostly in browns, shades of brown. It is Kim Hopper, 72, who works as a prep cook at Mad River Glen. Kim has fairly nicely arranged hair. It's gray, and it's a bit fluffy on top, and it's mainly short around the sides and back. She's wearing glasses, and she's smiling, I would say, bashfully at the camera. She's wearing a white T-shirt that says Mad River Glen on it. It also sports a snowflake, and she has some kind of a name tag. I can't read what, I guess it's her name, probably, but I can't read it. It's in smaller print. She's wearing dark pants and dark shoes and probably a waist-to-knee-length black apron. It's hard to tell because this is all fading into the shadows now of this dark room. She's got a big container, one of those spray containers of, I don't know, cleaning fluid probably, and she's standing next to something stainless steel that's very shiny. But that's Kim Hopper, 72. Now back to the, oh, we've got one more picture that I'll read the caption for. Now this is a man. He's seated on a stool, like a bar stool or a lunch counter stool, and he's got a really glitzy hat on. It's a knit ski cap deal, and it's in colors of red, blue, green, and it's got a fluffy thing on the top. And he's got a long sleeved brown plaid shirt covered by a black zip-up vest, and he's wearing dark pants and dark shoes, and he's sitting in what looks like a locker area. And I'll read the caption. He's wearing glasses, and he also has gray facial hair. Ron Anderson, 81, holds down a cashier's job at the resort. Okay, now back to the text. In the mornings, Carpenter sits down at a desk in his rent-subsidized apartment in downtown Montpelier and writes letters. He sends missives to newspaper editors about the need for single-payer health care, the problems with the private insurance market, the importance of gun control. Evidence of his policy advocacy adorns the otherwise bare walls of his Spartan apartment. There's a picture of him with Senator Bernie Sanders taken on the steps of the Vermont State Capitol. A letter from former Senator Patrick Leahy, a commendation from former Governor Peter Shumlin. Carpenter spends hours sitting at his big desk, the main piece of furniture in his couchless living room, writing about the flaws of the American economy. What will happen when, as a friend so aptly put it, I become too frail to work and too poor to live? He wrote in one 2017 letter advocating for state-sponsored retirement benefits. Carpenter became a health care advocate in 2006, he says, after he became seriously ill from a liver disease caused by gallstones in the bile ducts. His health insurance company would not pre-approve blood work and radiation radiology tests that were needed to figure out what was wrong, he recalls, forcing him to spend hours and hours on the phone with them, advocating for his own treatment. The illness forced him to take a 12-week absence from his job at Stowe Mountain Resort, which was owned by a different company than it is now. He had worked there since 1995 in a series of jobs that had health insurance and a 401k and paid $10 to $12 per hour. Not a huge sum, but well above a state minimum wage that sat at $7 at the time. But when Carpenter was ready to return to work, he says, the company had gone through a restructuring and his job was gone. He applied for other full-time gigs with benefits, but no one seemed to want to hire a 52-year-old man with a history of health problems. When people lose good jobs in their 50s, it is common for them to struggle in their 60s and in retirement, says Lisa Berkman, a professor of public policy and epidemiology at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, who has studied older workers. The 50s are a fork decade professionally, Berkman says. Around half of Americans are not working full-time throughout them, and the odds of those people being able to find good jobs in their 60s are low. In contrast, about 80% of people who work full-time through their 50s go on to work in their 60s. When you get to be 60, all the inequality that has accumulated over your lifetime comes into technicolor, Berkman says. So it has been for Carpenter. Since his illness, he's been a seasonal worker, spending winters at Mad River Glen and summers at Vermont's Waterbury Center State Park, where he's a park attendant, for $22 an hour. The pay isn't bad, but the cost of living in Vermont is higher than the national average. Even with a rent-subsidized apartment, Carpenter's finances are tight. There's $235 he has to pay monthly for his Medicare supplement and the $184 deducted from Social Security for Medicare Part B, plus hundreds of dollars on groceries, his cell phone bill, expenses for his car, which he drives about 50 miles per day to get to and from work in the winter. The salt does a number on the undercarriage of his 2015 Subaru Forester. One year he had to dip into his retirement savings to get it in shape for its annual inspection. Carpenter's situation may sound like bad luck, but it is a reality for many older Americans. About one in five people over 50 have no retirement savings at all, according to the AARP. The problem's getting worse over time. A 2023 government survey found 20% of low-income workers had a retirement account balance in 2007. But only 10% had one in 2019. Carpenter's had a colorful life. A self-identified hippie, he studied the flute at Berklee College of Music. He's taken trains across Canada, lived in Israel, survived the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. The hospitality industry found him when he moved back to the East Coast to care for his aging father, a professor, and started working odd jobs. This, too, is a common problem. As more people are thrust into caregiving for aging parents, they will either have to spend much-needed money for that care or scale back their own work, compromising their fragile finances even further. Carpenter sometimes wishes he had thought about retirement earlier when he was traveling the world and working part-time jobs. It can be hard sometimes to go to events like his high school reunion and see old schoolmates who are retired and financially secure. He is worried about what will happen over the next decade. That's why he scrimps and saves now, eating the half-priced food at Mad River Glen whenever he can, subsisting on deli meat from the kitchen. There's going to be a time when I cannot do this anymore, Carpenter says, wiping his hands on the dirty rag tucked into his pants. So for now, I have to save as much as I can. The sun is setting at Mad River Glen one December evening, and the cafeteria is closing. Customers clomp across the vast dining room in their ski boots, ready to go home. In the kitchen, things are slowing down. Workers mop the floor as a boombox blasts Grateful Dead. Carpenter tosses a green bag of sopping compost into a bin, then bends over to pick up a black plastic bag filled with trash. You have to know how to lift things in this job, he says, gesturing to the rolling cart full of trash bags and compost. Donning his jacket, he rolls the cart to the elevator, takes it to the ground floor, drags it outside. It's about 10 degrees, but Carpenter is cheerful as he hoists the trash, recycling, and compost, and tosses them in the proper bins. It is a job for a younger person. When it eventually becomes too difficult, he may ask to become a cashier, like his colleague Ron Anderson, 81, who retired from a career in advertising decades ago, then decided to come back to work for camaraderie and the free lift tickets given to all employees. As the nation ages, workers like Carpenter and Anderson will play a greater role in the economy. The Census Bureau predicts the 65 and older population in the U.S. will leap from 58 million in 2022 to 82 million by 2050. When the group is projected to make up more than a quarter of the country's population. The share of people in the workforce who are 55 and older is growing, while the proportion of people 16 to 54 has been shrinking since the late 1990s, according to a recent report by the Employee Benefit Research Institute. Older workers are becoming more prevalent as the youngest contributors to the economy. People 16 to 24 no longer work as often as they did, instead pursuing school or other interests. With its high proportion of older workers, Mad River Glen and the state it serves offer a glimpse of America's future. Vermont's the third oldest state in the nation. The number of residents 65 and older has nearly doubled during the past two decades, according to the Vermont State Data Center. The cost of living deters some people from moving here and often sends locals in search of an exit. As employers report worker shortages, state officials are beginning to look for ways to support older workers willing to fill the gap, says Mandeville, the 75-year-old Council on Aging director. That is how a business like the Trapp Family Lodge, a resort in Stowe, Vermont, came to put out an ad in 2022 that targeted retirees. Are you retired and looking for a part-time job to get you out of the house, make play money? It asked. Bob Schwartz, the resort's marketing director, said the idea came as management looked for the low-hanging fruit to beef up our workforce. Flexibility is one of the biggest demands from older workers, says Gina Trumbly, Director of Human Resources at the Clara Martin Center, a nonprofit mental health facility in Vermont. The center has cobbled together a staff by hiring many older people for part-time jobs, agreeing to give them ample time to travel or visit their grandkids. The center has kept on some long-time workers by allowing them to transfer from full-time to part-time, keeping their knowledge in the organization. It is a win-win all the way around, she says. Japan's a good model for what America might look like if its workforce is increasingly made up of older people. About 80% of Japanese workers want to continue their jobs after retirement, according to the World Economic Forum, and about 1 in 4 people 65 and older were still working in 2022. The country's encouraged companies to help by employing older workers and raising the mandatory retirement age above 60. Technology helps, too. Some companies have used robots to help elderly workers continue at jobs that their bodies might not otherwise be able to do. But having everyone work longer is not the only option. A new type of savings plan spreading around the U.S. could help more people put aside money for retirement, called an auto IRA. The plan sets aside money from people's paychecks, which it then invests in stocks and bonds. The program costs employers nothing. Their only responsibility is to inform workers about it. This means people who, for the most part, never had a chance to save can do so, says David John, a senior policy advisor to the AARP, who helped invent the concept. Vermont passed a law allowing auto IRAs in 2023, and 17 other states either have operational auto IRAs or are putting plans in place. In some states, like California, almost all employers have to participate. The program appears to be helping workers grow their retirement savings in the states where it's already operational, according to the Pew Charitable Trusts. More than a million people have amassed more than $1 billion in assets through such plans since 2018, according to John. In one Pew survey, nearly two-thirds of low-wage workers participating in an auto IRA plan in Illinois said they were satisfied with it. Walter Carpenter supports the idea. In one of his letter-writing campaigns in 2017, he penned a missive to the online publication VT Digger, advocating for Vermont to support state-sponsored retirement plans. In the letter, Carpenter referred to himself as someone who knows what it means to lose any hope of retirement through circumstances beyond my control. Employers in Vermont can now start offering this type of plan, but unfortunately, Carpenter's unable to avail himself of the benefits now. It is too late for the contributions he had made at this point to amount to much. He reflects on this as he sits in the basement staff dressing room at Mad River Glen, pulling off his apron, swapping his work boots for snow boots, and his jeans and sweatshirt for something clean. Someone who's worked for 55 years like me should be able to retire, he says. Instead, he keeps going, one foot in front of the other. He's cleaned the kitchen counters with dish soap, taken out the trash, stacked chairs on tables. He's ready to go home for the night, but he'll be back tomorrow. And for many days after that. I'm turning now to the Women of the Year section. As mentioned on the cover, it's 13 extraordinary leaders fighting for a more equal future. And I may or may not read all of them. Some of the columns are rather lengthy. The photograph that I described to you on the cover of this edition is by Petra Collins for Time. Here it is again of Nicole Kidman. This is a long article about Nicole Kidman, and I will abbreviate it to some extent. Nicole Kidman, Championing Women on Both Sides of the Camera, by Eliana Doctorman. In the days after giving birth, Nicole Kidman found herself unable to breastfeed. I was so terrified, asking, "What just happened? Where's my milk?" she says. I remember standing naked in the shower, and my sister helped me. She was my source of strength. She had had five children. She had the wisdom to pass on. Kidman and I are curled up in chairs beside a fireplace inside an historic Nashville home, not far from the house the Oscar winner shares with her husband, Keith Urban, and their two daughters, and a serene poodle named Julian. Kidman's warm and disarmingly inquisitive. She wants to hear about my postpartum experience, too. Perhaps I should not be surprised by the ease of this conversation about vulnerable moments in our lives as women. Kidman, 57, has emotionally exposed herself on screen for decades. On the drama Big Little Lies, she huddled under a towel between shooting scenes of domestic violence. In her latest film, Baby Girl, she growled while masturbating on the floor. She marks all her scripts with notes about her characters, coded for privacy. Then she shreds them. "It's too personal. I want it gone." filmmakers adore her rawness. People believe if you have power, you do not have to go to a place of vulnerability, says Oscar-winning director Jane Campion, Kidman's longtime friend. A lot of actors won't do that because it's uncomfortable. For Kidman to be truly open with a director requires a leap of faith. She describes herself as trusting to a fault. It is how I approach all my relationships. I have been hurt because of that, but I'm still not jaded, she says. I am delicate, but I'm very giving. The emotions I offer are very, very real. So I need to know that if I'm giving that to you, you value it. She's found that women behind the camera often offer a support, reminiscent of how her sister cared for her in those early days after childbirth. And Kidman has made it her mission to use her immense star power to shine a light on emerging directors like Helena Rein, who helmed The Bold Baby Girl, about a CEO who submits to an intern in a dominant, submissive affair. Many actors called out the dearth of opportunities for female filmmakers in the Me Too era, but few followed through on promoting talent. Kidman pledged in 2017 to work with a woman director every 18 months. She has far exceeded her promise, partnering as a producer and actor with 19 in film and TV over the past 8 years. In 2023, fewer than 15% of films released theatrically were directed by women. For those who do receive funding and support, Kidman says, there is undue pressure to be perfect on the first outing. It can be changed, she says, but it can only be changed by actually being in the films of women. That is Nicole Kidman, and that lengthy article was abridged. Olivia Munn, Raising Awareness About Breast Cancer, by Jamie Ducharme. I will read this column. It will be about the same number of lines as the Olivia Kidman article that I abridged. When Olivia Munn was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2023, she struggled even to tell her family. Her now husband, comedian John Mulaney, had to break the news to her relatives because the words got stuck in my throat, the actor says. Later, she found her voice in a big way. In a March 2024 Instagram post, Munn detailed her winding health journey. Just months before her diagnosis, she had a clean mammogram and tested negative for numerous genetic signatures associated with cancer. It wasn't until her OBGYN used the Tyrer-Cuzick Risk Assessment Calculator, a simple tool, that concluded Munn had a 37% chance of developing breast cancer, that she pursued additional testing, which revealed fast-growing cancer in both breasts. She had a double mastectomy shortly thereafter and subsequently had her uterus, fallopian tubes, and ovaries removed to stop production of hormones that could feed her disease. It was because her diagnosis was so unexpected that Munn decided to speak out. I look at videos of me laughing with my son, running around in the park, feeling and looking healthy, all the while having this really aggressive, fast-moving cancer spreading through my breasts, she says. I thought, man, there's so many women out there just like me, they might have no idea, and it may be too late by the time they find out. Munn's candor has had a tangible impact. After she came forward, the National Cancer Institute saw an uptick in the use of the type of screening test she took, and at least one person, journalist Allison Hall, has gone public about being diagnosed as a result. It was everything that I hoped would happen, Munn says. Although Munn, 44, is still recovering, taking a range of medications, weathering the effects of medically induced menopause, she's also easing back into work, co-starring in the forthcoming Apple TV Plus drama, Your Friends and Neighbors. These days, Munn says, she has a simple barometer for roles. If something comes around that makes me really happy, then I will do it. She's applying the same philosophy to life. Conscious of the pivotal role hormones play in her health, she's lowering her stress levels as much as possible. In difficult situations, the first thing I ask myself is, if this stress feeds any cancer that could possibly be in my body, would it be worth it? Munn says. The answer's always no. Two more of these women from Time's list before I set this aside. Fatou, F-A-T-O-U, Balde, B-A-L-D-E-H, Fighting Female Genital Mutilation by Chantel Lee. For Fatou Balde, maybe I'm mispronouncing that. If I am, I apologize. The past year was critical in the fight to end female genital mutilation. A survivor and founder of the organization Women in Liberation and Leadership, WILL, Balde, 41, is a leading activist fighting against the practice in Gambia. Although FGM has been banned in her country since 2015, it still happens. About 75% of women and girls ages 15 to 49 have been cut, according to the United Nations Population Fund. FGM can lead to long-lasting health effects and is internationally recognized as a human rights violation. Advocates say the law banning the practice is poorly enforced. We continue to have those issues where we will have a case. We go to the police and report, and the police would be like, this is our culture, this is our tradition. So they do not see it as a crime, Balde says. This past year, Gambian parliamentarians considered a bill to overturn the ban. This was an attack on women's rights, Balde says. She and WILL worked with other organizations to fight the bill. They connected with survivors who shared their experiences with parliamentarians and discussed the issue with religious leaders. They conducted a nationwide study to document the health impacts of FGM and brought that evidence to politicians, and they succeeded. In July 2024, Gambia's parliament rejected the bill. Balde says this past year has opened up the conversation. People are talking about it, and that's a positive thing, because we cannot end the practice if we do not talk about it. Balde says news of the bill has brought the issue of FGM back in the limelight, not just for Gambia, but for the rest of the world, too. In 2025, and little girls are being pinned down, and their genitals are being cut in the name of culture and tradition. She says, when this whole issue happened in Gambia, it really made people pay attention. Raquel Willis, Standing Up for Bodily Autonomy by Erin McMullen. Raquel Willis is not afraid to take risks. She's organized large-scale marches to protest violence against black trans lives and rallied outside the Supreme Court to support the trans youth at the center of the ongoing case U.S. v. Scrimeti, which will decide whether gender-affirming health care bans for minors are constitutional. Last December, Willis was arrested at the Capitol for staging a bathroom sit-in in defiance of a proposal to ban trans women from women's restrooms on federal property. The title of her 2023 memoir, The Risk It Takes to Bloom, underlines her fearlessness. But to Willis, a proud Southern black trans queer woman from Augusta, Georgia, the riskiest thing she's done so far is choose to live authentically. Our society is not primed to honor queerness or transness, she says. Willis, 33, is co-founder of Gender Libertarian Movement, GLM, the grassroots collective responsible for the Brooklyn Liberation Marches that drew thousands of people in 2020 and 2021. In 2024, GLM organized an inaugural Gender Liberation March in Washington, D.C., in an effort to highlight the ways in which the fights for abortion and trans rights are connected. For us, gender liberation is about bodily autonomy, self-determination, the pursuit of fulfillment, and collectivism, she explains. We want to be the glue between these different fights and get people talking about how restrictive ideas around gender impact us all. The way Willis sees it, restrictions on choices surrounding our bodies pose a danger to everyone, no matter how you identify. Many institutions have failed us and will continue to do so, she says. Since President Trump's inauguration, a number of executive orders targeting trans and gender nonconforming people have already been signed. One state of the U.S. will recognize only two sexes, male and female. But thinking of the long road ahead, Willis is trying to maintain a sense of calm. We have to remember that communities on the margins have experienced struggles and hardships in every era. We'll figure out solutions that serve us. And perhaps unsurprisingly, she adds, I'm going to find ways to take risks to move us closer to collective liberation. Okay, moving now from the Women's Leadership of Time pages to Time Off Movies, Capturing the Humanity That War Threatens to Destroy, by Simon Schuster. War has a way of attracting storytellers, different kinds, at different phases of the story. Usually the journalists get there first, before the authors and historians arrive to place events in a grander narrative. The artists tend to be among the stragglers, though their works, once out in the world, can have the greatest resonance. The release of Porcelain War, the Oscar-nominated documentary about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, shows that artists have arrived to tell their version, and it is unlike anything the experts and reporters have shown us. For the filmmakers, this was no accident. My main fear in making the film, the co-director, Slava Leontiev, told me recently, was that we would end up capturing something like a reportage. His partner on the project, Anya Stasenko, puts an even finer point on it. I refuse to make it about the blood and gore and violence. Set in the frontline city of Kharkiv, about 25 miles from the Russian border, the film cannot escape the violence of the war and does not seek to sugarcoat it. Russian shells rain down constantly, killing thousands, forcing over a million civilians to flee the area. Leontiev, the co-director, serves in the Ukrainian Special Forces, and we follow his unit into battle at one point in the film, watching the carnage through the cameras they attached to their uniforms. But this scene is an exception. The film's main focus is not on the war itself, but its antithesis, the beauty and humanity that war destroys. The action follows three artists, Leontiev and Stasenko, as well as their friend Andrei Stefanov, an oil painter, who doubles as the film's cinematographer. They fight not only with weapons, but also through their struggle to continue making art, even as the air raid sirens howl. These acts of creation, Leontiev explains, become a critical form of resistance against the Russians, whose goal in this war is not only to conquer Ukrainian territory, but to eradicate your Ukrainian culture. The porcelain in the title, Porcelain War, of the film refers to the figurines Leontiev and Stasenko create, depicting phantasmagorical creatures like a baby dragon and a Pegasus. This is the first film they and Stefanov have made. At the start of the invasion, they relied on their American collaborator, Brendan Bellamo, writer, editor, and co-director of the film, to provide equipment and teach them how to use it via video calls. Bellamo never went to Ukraine to help them. yet the brilliance of what they captured earned them an Oscar nomination for Best Documentary Feature. Last year, the Oscar in that category went to another film about the war, 20 Days in Mariupol, a towering work of journalism made during the Russian siege of that city in southern Ukraine. Its director, Mstislav Chernov, a war correspondent for the Associated Press, has often spoken of his desire to show the war in all its horror, even as he recognized the risks of doing that. "To watch people crying, it's hard," he said in January 2023. "When you place an audience for 90 minutes into this chaos and this mess and this violence, there's a risk of people getting too overwhelmed or even pushed back by the amount of this violence." President Volodymyr Zelensky, himself a former filmmaker and comic actor, understands how hard it is to keep the world's attention as the war grinds on year after year. "It is a lot of blood, a lot of emotion, and that tires people," Zelensky told Time soon after the invasion. He still spends much of his time persuading the world not to succumb to what some pundits call Ukraine fatigue. Porcelain War, through its beauty and the magnetism of its characters, offers another way to address this challenge. The film connects in a quieter register, one that only works of art can reach. As the war enters its fourth year, Ukraine needs new ways to tell its story, and artists may turn out to be its greatest messengers. Time Off Television Review. 0 Days, Uncannily Apolitical Washington, by Judy Berman. This will be abridged. It's a longer article. In an early scene of the Netflix thriller 0 Day, that's two words, a former U.S. president is visiting the site of a deadly Manhattan subway crash when an onlooker starts shouting about crisis actors. A fight breaks out. Barricades fall. The chaos horrifies George Mullen, a revered leader played by Robert De Niro, who's been summoned to soothe the public after a cataclysmic event. "What's the matter with you?" he scolds the agitator. "If we keep shouting at each other, what are we going to accomplish? We're Americans. You're afraid, and you think if you get worked up over some bullshit conspiracy nonsense, that won't make you afraid? No. You're not behaving like an American, nor a patriot." It is a cathartic rant, even if you're aware that it takes more than a stern lecture from an authority figure to cure conspiracy thinking, and especially if you've been less than impressed with the moral instincts or off-the-cuff oratory of our last few real commanders-in-chief. Intelligent, principled, brave, Mullen has all the qualities any reasonable person would want in a president. As an admirer marvels, he was also the last president in modern memory who was able to consistently rally bipartisan support. Which raises the question, what political party does Mullen actually represent? What policies did he champion? What did he accomplish? We never find out. Creators Eric Newman, American Primeval, Narcos, and Noah Oppenheim, a former president of NBC News, are so thorough in their avoidance of naming characters, parties, and positions, it must have been a choice. 0 Day is a well-built political thriller with a superb cast and blockbuster production values. It takes pains to establish an atmosphere of division and distrust that mirrors the present. Yet it's evasion of the substance of contemporary American polarization, an increasingly common approach in a Hollywood desperate for hits that will play in red states, blue states, internationally, undermines that verisimilitude. The show's extreme efforts to avoid offense, the bromides about truth and liberty it offers in lieu of more specific and potentially controversial insights, feel a bit like a betrayal of its plain-spoken hero. When we meet President Mullen, he's immersed in the pleasures of retirement. living in bucolic upstate New York. He goes on leisurely morning jogs with his dog, swims in an outdoor pool worthy of Architectural Digest, neglects a long-delayed memoir as his publisher grows impatient, but when the nation's hit with a cyber attack, the power grid briefly crashes, causing accidents that kill thousands, as "This Will Happen Again" appears on every smartphone screen, George is persuaded by the current POTUS, a presidential but underused Angela Bassett, to find the culprit and prevent a second catastrophe. A president's work is never done, even when he's no longer president. When Russia emerges as the obvious suspect, evidence points elsewhere. George has the integrity to follow it. There is a sense that in leading the investigative commission, he's resolving unfinished business. A popular single-term president, he declined to run for re-election after the death of his adult son. You may well notice parallels to a certain recent occupant of the White House. But as ethical and sharp as he usually seems, George is still an elderly man with a bathroom cabinet full of prescriptions. Moments of disorientation, coupled with what might be hallucinations, force him to question the soundness of his mind, and he's not the only one. Netflix was clearly invested in making Zero Day a hit. Directed by prestige TV fixture Leslie Linka Glatter, Homeland, Mad Men, the six-episode series is as stylish and fleet as any feature thriller and smartly deploys its big-name actors. George's wife, a judge portrayed by Joan Allen, is worried enough about him to beg his hyper-competent former White House chief of staff, Connie Britton, to join the commission. Lizzie Kaplan is George's aggrieved daughter, Alex, a congresswoman. Alex has found a surrogate father in Matthew Modine's slick House Speaker. Jesse Plemons is George's in-over-his-head deputy. Gabby Hoffman, Dan Stevens, and Bill Camp have small but crucial roles. Zero Day is, among other things, the ultimate example of the so-called dad show, an oasis for men of a certain age amid a TV landscape full of unscripted soaps, Bridgerton clones, auteur dramedies. Dad shows find traditionally masculine, mostly AARP-eligible heroes solving crimes or leading empires or fighting for their families, if not all three at once. Genres vary from action thrillers like the Idris Elba-led Hijack to medical dramas like The Pitt to the Yellowstone Western franchise starring Kevin Costner and Harrison Ford. The constant is the archetype of one righteous man with the courage to save the day. Zero Day does more than most dad shows to humanize this character, a credit to both the writing and De Niro's turn as an august leader struggling with his own decline and that of a nation where he once wielded supreme power. It also makes smart and inventive use of 21st century history to conjure a fictional crisis that feels real. George's investigation recalls the closely watched work of Robert Mueller. Supporting first responders on the site of the subway crash, he brings to mind a pre-disgrace Rudy Giuliani, reassuring a terrified nation after 9/11. Hoffman's tech billionaire rings true in the age of surveillance capitalism. One character's fate has echoes of the Jeffrey Epstein case. Even as the plot twists become a bit far-fetched, the world George inhabits remains grounded in our own. So vivid is Zero Day's evocation of contemporary corruption and unrest that its evasiveness on political affiliations plunges it into the realm of the uncanny. We get the sense Americans were agitated long before the attack, though details remain murky. The show leans hard on assumptions viewers across the political spectrum will bring without challenging any one set. It shares with another recent, cautiously nonpartisan Netflix thriller, The Madness, an inherently uncontroversial aberrance of extremists, no matter their agenda. One character rages against half the country caught up in a fever dream of lies and conspiracy, and the other half shouting about pronouns and ranking their grievances, a nod to reality that's also a false equivalence for the ages. In an era when TV aimed at mass audiences, from Netflix's splashy The Diplomat to Amazon's dopey spy franchise Citadel, often tries to set stories within governments while avoiding partisan statements, Zero Day stands out for taking on American polarization without so much as identifying its characters' parties. This limits our grasp of their motives and relationships. That Newman and Oppenheim felt that they needed to go to such lengths to keep viewers red, blue, and independent, rooting for a hero played by De Niro, speaks to how ossified our biases have become, or at least how spooked platforms and creators are by them. The blandly universal dilemma it finally puts before George is whether a need for safety and self-protection must necessarily supersede the confrontation of an unpopular truth. It is a question the creators might have asked themselves. That article by Judy Berman was only slightly abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.